This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives?
This is Wade Rathkin. You're listening to Wage World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the U.S., and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at KABF.org or affiliatedmediamovement.org. A podcast will be available to the show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Professor Vivian Fried at Vanderbilt University about her new book, Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art Since 1970. Welcome to Wade's World, Professor Fried.
Thank you, Wade. Thank you for inviting me to have this conversation with you.
Well, and, you know, this is a trigger alert. This is rough stuff. Sexual trauma, we're talking, of course, the name of the book, as soon as my partner, you know, lifelong feminist, against our will.
She knew what that was, right?
She grabbed the book. I said, I actually need that book. I've got to read that before, you know, later this week I'm doing this interview. And she was on her way out the door with the damn thing. So I guess since we're telling that story, we better say the name obviously does bring back a lot of memories for many of us who follow this. And why don't you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, so the first half of the title of my book is based on Susan Brownmiller's book published in 1975 called Against Our Will, Men, Women, and American Culture. And what she did in her book, and she was one of the very first people to do this, she examined the subject of rape from antiquity to the present. And she argued that rape had nothing to do with sex or sexual desire. It was instead a man's attempt to subjugate women and to control them by way of violence. This was such a new concept in the 1970s. It was groundbreaking. But her book was published a couple of years after some of the artists that I discuss in my book, Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art Since 1970, I show that some artists already in the 1960s and the very beginning of the 1970s began to address the subject in performance art. And they, too, were suggesting that it was about male control over the woman's body. But they also wanted to end the silence, have the subject enter into public awareness and memory, and they were very much political activists.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that is now, I mean, does anyone really argue with Brownmiller's point anymore that it's about power?
That's a good question, Wade. I have to pause for a minute. I'm not sure that that's the issue. The issue doesn't come to, is it about power? The issue is, can we believe her? Can we believe Christine Blasey Ford? Is she telling the truth? Or there's the question of, well, somebody's claiming that you remember this, but how do we know that this really happened? So I think those are more the responses than questioning if it's about an issue of power anymore.
Some of that's about power, specifically the, you know, first thing about Blakely. But, you know, Brownmiller argued that it was not about sex, it was about power, it was domination.
Yeah. Right?
So that's really what
Absolutely.
I meant. And some of these artists, I mean, for those people who are lucky enough to have the book or get the book, I mean, there are some illustrations that come with the book. And some of these early pioneers, it's just you sort of you'd be reading it and all of a sudden you'd come to the picture and you'd say, holy moly. I mean,
right.
So I don't know how to describe some of that, but I'm going to let you do it since you're the author. But one woman leaning over and blood everywhere and her pants around her ankle. Oh, my God. You wanted to get up with a stick and go looking for somebody. I mean, terrible.
That's Anna Mendieta. Anna Mendieta was a graduate student in studio at University of Iowa. And she heard about a fellow student who had been brutally raped. Nobody was really talking about this. She decided to do a number of performances dealing with this. And they are, as you said, graphic and shocking, shocking in so many ways. But she was intending to create something that would shock people and that would start a discussion about rape and this is so early, it's in the beginning of the 1970s. We're now talking about college rape as if it's a new topic, but obviously not.
Absolutely. And the 1970s, I mean, now we have, the richest people in the world showing pictures of their, private parts everywhere. But then for someone to do what this artist was doing, exposing herself fully without clothes and that wasn't, I was around 1970. That wasn't normal. That wasn't, the usual thing. Oh, gee, there's somebody without clothes. That wasn't, as performance art, it must have been, especially powerful.
Oh, it was definitely powerful. Now, her works were not seen by a lot of people at the time that she did them because they were on the university campus.
Right.
But then her works become cycled and recycled up to the present so that other art historians and artists begin to talk about her and talk about her art, include her in exhibitions in the 1980s and 1990s. But then there were other artists such as Suzanne Lacy and Leslie Labowitz. They collaborated on about 8 or 9 performances in the 1970s dealing with the subject of rape. And sometimes the images were graphic, and sometimes they were graphic, but in a different way. For example, Suzanne Lacy did a performance called Maps. And what she did is she had huge 2 maps of L.A. located in the mall and the underneath City Hall in Los Angeles. And over a 2-week period, she stamped in red the word rape, every place a rape occurred in the city of Los Angeles. And then on the right map, she placed where places were where you could go for assistance, so a rape crisis center or something along those lines. Over time, over this 2-week period, individuals who would just be in the mall shopping or politicians who were going to City Hall, obviously, to work, would pass by the map, and over time, they would become aware that the red word rape was just increasing so that it completely covered the map.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a little more, it was on the one hand more subtle because you're not seeing the literal rape of an individual or a naked body with the blood. But on the other hand, it's graphically showing you the number of rapes that were happening in a short period of time and how many rapes were occurring in alarming numbers. And again, this is the first time that somebody was paying attention to these statistics about the number of rapes that were occurring in Los Angeles or any other city in the United States or town.
Well, and actually that was part of what impressed me as a community organizer. In 1977, it was so difficult, and I mean obviously Los Angeles, it must have been possible for the artist, but it was almost impossible, as Suzanne Lacy we were talking about, but it was almost impossible to get those statistics at that sort of granular detail in 1977.
Right.
We had campaigns all around the country, and Memphis is one of the largest places right in that year. And there was a young child who was molested in a high school, and it became a huge issue for our neighborhood group. And you couldn't buy or steal the statistics, because the police, you know, in many cases were just not willing to provide them. This is not something they saw as a primary part of their job. This was still a contentious thing. So that must have been just amazing.
Yeah.
And that map must still exist.
Well, it still exists. Wade, thank you for sharing that story, because it indicates that what the artists were dealing with were, in fact, everyday occurrences that were not really being addressed. Here you had a community where you were addressing it probably for the first time. And if you think about today, the church, all the famous people in Hollywood and newscasters, and the list goes on, we're talking about it so much because of the Me Too movement and because of social media. But my book makes it clear that the Me Too movement is really a continuation of what began in the 1970s, and that feminist artists in my book relentlessly dealt with over and over and over again in order to demand we pay attention to the topic and that we, as I said, end the silence. But they were political activists who were encouraging politicians to make changes in the legal system to actually have rape sex kits made, which is still an issue right now. And the second map that Suzanne Lacy had that showed where you could go for assistance, that was brand new. There were no sexual abuse centers prior to the 1970s. And what Suzanne Lacy was saying is these phone numbers of where to get help need to be in the phone book. So they weren't even in the phone book until she advocated it.
Crazy. We're talking to Professor Vivian Fried, who has a new book, Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art Since 1970. This is rough stuff, but sexual trauma, you make a very interesting and important argument about this trauma as driving the artist, but why don't you go through that just a bit as well?
Sexual trauma or trauma, we all know the term PTSD.
We've had to learn that, yes. That's another term we've had to learn in the last 50 years,
right.
Exactly.
But you probably your audience would not be aware of the fact that PTSD was not defined by the psychiatric, the American Psychiatric Association until 1980. So prior to that time, there was no medical name for what we now consider to be PTSD. It's actually Freud who first identified trauma in his therapy, seeing women who were having problems, and he attributed them to sexual abuse by fathers and brothers, etc. And then the response was so adverse that he, believe it or not, came up with the Oedipal complex.
The part of your book where you show how he was fishtailing back and forth on the argument was, I mean, how you could ever take him seriously if you didn't know it already, if you read that and said, oh, my goodness, let me go read, books by Sigmund Freud. I mean, what fantasy that you could change your analysis based on a couple of people pushing back, particularly from the male hierarchy?
Well, he changed his opinion because of the First World War, and he realized that the vets from the war had the same symptoms as the women, and then he thought, wait a minute, and he came back to it. But this concept of trauma doesn't recircle in the psychiatric profession until the late 1970s. These artists are really predating many of the therapists who were first starting to address the subject. And it was mostly women therapists who were saying, oh, we're seeing a pattern of behavior on the part of women who have experienced a sexual trauma, the hypervigilance, the extreme fear, the nightmares, the depression, the suicidal thoughts, the binge eating, the over-sexualized behavior, or the under-sexualized behavior, and the list goes on. As I said, it wasn't until 1980, however, that the American Psychiatric Association came up with the term post-traumatic stress disorder, and it applied to Vietnam War veterans, survivors of rape, Holocaust survivors, etc.
But people still often are not as your book argues, and certainly this is what we know as common knowledge, still aren't willing, as willing to credit women on PTSD as they are veterans, for example?
I agree with you. I mean, I'm going to go back to Christine Blasey Ford. Her testimony for me, and I am a survivor of sexual abuse, and for me, listening to her testimony was very real.
Absolutely.
The way in which she spoke, the pauses, the inability to remember specific facts, that is just so common. And for me, all of that indicated that, yes, this is her truth. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she was being dismissed or questioned in the way that she was questioned just makes it clear that we still are not ready to listen to women, but it's also men. My book makes clear that the feminist artists in the 1970s are only addressing women as victims of sexual trauma, but as we now know, men can also be victims as young boys and also as adult men. It's not until the 1980s with the growth of the men's movement that some men began to deal with this in art, which I address in my book.
Absolutely. And you also address this, the problem of incest as an identical kind of deep-seated issue.
Well, I would say that incest is one of the more difficult things to be talking about because it's the family.
Absolutely.
And so, somebody doesn't want to talk about it, doesn't want to remember it, doesn't want to acknowledge it happened, doesn't want to believe that it happened, because a family, your parents are supposed to be taking care of you. If you are a victim of incest, a boy or a girl, then you have grown up in a home where nobody was there to take care of you, just the opposite. And so that fear, that depression, that detachment, the flashbacks, the sense of helplessness or horror, all of that can be understood if you think about what it is for a child to be experiencing that.
Which also makes it even more brave or even more powerful in some cases to be able to have some people translate it into art, doesn't it?
Yes. So I want to refer to a work of art by Faith Ringgold. She is an African-American artist who lives in New York City, and she did a quilt called The Slave Rape Story Quilt in 1984-1985 that combines text and image. And she creates a fictional first-person narrative about a character, Beata, who is born into slavery on a slave ship. Her mother had been raped by the slave trader, and she is brought, this is Beata, is brought onto a plantation in South Carolina. And on the plantation, she is raped by the slave owner, who is also her father. So she's dealing with incest within the context of slavery and how it becomes transgenerational, that her mother experienced it, she is experiencing it, is her daughter then going to experience it? And as we know that that kind of behavior does go on in families. It's a learned behavior.
And the statistics are terrible. You know, at one point in your book, you mentioned that 879,000 children,
right,
substantiated victims of maltreatment. I'm reading from it now. 10% of these cases,
yeah,
during the same year involve sexual violation. The math is easy. That's almost 88,000 people. In 2008, 15% of reported sexual assault and rape victims were younger than 12, and 29%
right,
were between the ages of 12 and 17. I almost couldn't get past that one. But luckily, you know, you were on my schedule. I was going to come through with it. But, wow, I mean, you know. And so the art, what's been the impact of these artists, you believe, on this issue? I mean, they've given voice. They've talked about things that have been hidden.
They made people aware. I mean, again, if we think about the works that Suzanne Lacy and Leslie Labowitz did, that some of them were done in private galleries, but then when they brought it to the public sphere, like City Hall, then so many people got to see the works. And then these artists were so savvy before social media, they invited television and radio stations to come and record what they were doing and invited politicians to record. But many of the artists I discuss in my book then are dealing with that subject over and over and over again. And they, too, are having, they're exhibiting it in galleries or in museums or other locations. And they, too, are asking the viewer to bear witness so that it enters into public memory. Probably Kara Walker would be, I don't know if your listeners would know Kara Walker. She's a contemporary artist known for her huge silhouettes that have been seen all over the world. And
she's one I've actually seen at the new museum in New York a couple of years ago. And, happened to just stumble into it, wasn't familiar with it.
Right.
Wow, that is so powerful. I mean, because you think you're looking at something different until you really look. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. She creates this plantation, which you think, oh, we're back in the old South.
It's a Grandma Moses thing. Oh, no, it's not.
But all of a sudden you start looking, and you see all of this inappropriate and violent behavior. But in her world, everything is topsy-turvy. It's whites doing to blacks, but it's blacks doing to whites, and it's children and adults, and it's what she's in her works that she creates so many of them, silhouettes and so many drawings and videos and sculpture, and in her world, nobody is free from A, being exposed to this behavior, and B, having participated in it in some fashion. And she is forcing us to face racism and all of its ugliness, which unfortunately we have to address because of what's happening in our culture right now.
Absolutely. But I don't want to finish this without going to some of you. You, Judy Chicago, is certainly the most famous person in the book. And in 2006, you and others were part of a collaboration with with her. And I want to make sure we get that story from you, because that I thought, oh, whoa, there you go.
Yeah. So Judy Chicago, your listeners, she is probably the most famous artist for, known for her dinner party. And she had returned to the idea of creating installations within a home that she had done in Woman House with Miriam Shapiro back in the 1970s. She and her husband, Donald Woodman, returned to that at Western Kentucky University with the At Home Project. And because I taught Judy in my class on American art since 1975, I thought, oh, I'm
Oh, wow. Look, I like the way you snuck that in. Look at that. Okay.
All of a sudden, I'm looking at this, and I see the rape garage, I see the incest nursery, which I see the domestic abuse closet, and I started taking copious notes and returned a couple of times and wrote everything up, not knowing I was going to be writing this book. And then Judy came to Vanderbilt to teach with me and with her husband for a semester. And our students did installations in a beautiful building on campus by McKinney White, the famous 19th century architect. At any rate, two students in our class had experienced rape, and they did powerful, powerful works addressing the subject, really incredible works.
And you also raised that Vanderbilt has more recently been connected with all these problems. Athletic teams and everything else. So
we have that case of a freshman who was being carried by, I think it's four football players, in a dorm. And thank God that we had cameras, and there was a security guard who was watching this. I'm laughing, but it's not a laughing matter. And he immediately called the police. And your listeners may be aware of that. They tried to erase on their cell phones with what they had documented, and they're all in jail now.
Yeah.
But that poor woman is having to still survive and deal with her experience. She's gone to graduate school, and I've heard that she's doing well, but still not 100%.
I'm sure that's true. And did any art in Vanderbilt come out of that experience?
No, not that I know of. There may be somebody who has dealt with it, but not that I know of.
Got you. So the Me Too era, we're now in the world of Trump. What is that going to mean for us, Professor, in terms of art?
Well, I suspect that artists are going to be creating works of art addressing Donald Trump and what our president has said. On page 14, I quote him in terms of exactly what he said on that tape that was the Access Hollywood tape that was that we've all, if you want, you can Google it and find it, but I can't repeat it on air.
Thank God, yeah.
There are too many words that I can't repeat on air. That's incredibly sad. I suspect somebody's going to be dealing with that at some point. Maybe it'll be Emma Sulkowitz, the mattress girl, who at Columbia
University. Yeah, that's what I was about to ask, because you also brought this very case about Trump and the mattress situation. A lot of people don't know. I mean, it's gotten a huge amount of press in the Times and other places, but share what that is all about.
So Emma Sulkowitz was a sophomore at Columbia University when she alleged that she was raped by a student. Brought charges against him. The university found him to be innocent. Her senior year, as her senior year art project that she had to do over the entire academic year, she did a performance called Carry That Mattress. And she carried the mattress from her room to all of her classes and even her graduation. Because of social media, this became known to people on other campuses. So students at other campuses began to carry mattresses. Students on the Columbia campus began to carry mattresses. And I think it was a very powerful, powerful performance piece.
I think she even carried a mattress to her graduation, didn't she?
She carried it to her graduation. Now, unfortunately, Columbia University has settled with the student and claimed that the student, that is the alleged student, was treated unfairly. And this fits in with...
And it almost exonerated him in their earlier disciplinary procedures, hasn't it?
It definitely exonerated him. And this fits in with Trump administration and Betsy DeVos, who's now saying that we need to pay attention to the poor boys who are victimized of false accusations. And yes, some accusations are false. We have to say that is the case.
I mean, we need a fair procedure, but right now there's nothing fair about the procedure, and certainly Secretary Voss has no interest in it necessarily being fair, or at least not from what we can see from the rest of her record.
No, I don't think so.
I think we've convinced people this is a book people need to get their hands on. This is not, you know, if you're saying, oh, what do I know about art and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is not just art. This is how politics and contemporary life interweave with art in a very powerful way, particularly with some of our most effective feminist artists over recent decades. But you also look at the history. But before, Professor Fried, how can people get a hold of this book?
The book is sold. You can find it on Amazon. And my last name is spelled F as in Frank, R as in Richard, Y as in yesterday, D as in David. It's a very strange spelling for Fried. So you can find it on Amazon. You can find it at, it's being published and sold by Pennsylvania State University Press. So those
are two places. Is there a website or anything like that?
There's a website. I have a website through Vanderbilt University.
Great. Why don't you, if you don't mind, share that?
You know what? I'd have to find it.
Well, don't worry. How about is there an email that people, if they have more questions, they want to say, oh, my goodness, you worked with Nancy Chicago, you know, Judy Chicago, and I just want to know more about this book. Can they get a hold of you?
Yes, it's Vivian, V-I-V-I-E, as in Ellen, N, Vivian, .G, as in Green, .Fried, F-R-Y-D, at Vanderbilt.edu. And if you Google me, you would access, you would get to my website at Vanderbilt immediately.
Absolutely, and there's a million ways, and if you really get desperate, just get back a hold of us on our stations. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wage World. Thank you.
Thank you, Wade.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, a grassroots effort to produce public radio news and information serving the needs of low and moderate income working Americans by providing a platform for voices not commonly heard in mainstream media. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.